So has everyone got a copy of this or enough that we can share? I'd just like to do a bit of study with you. So let's go to the morning meditation. Where is the morning meditation? How much? Okay. Oh, sure. That's right. So on page, so if we go to page 22. So I'd just like to reflect on the five khandhas, which is a way that most of you might have seen, the way we describe our conscious experience. And that's an important set of concepts if you read Buddhism. The thing is, any tradition has its jargon, and a teacher will assume that the listeners know the jargon, and if you don't, you can get a bit lost. So these five khandhas you'll find, I think, in all forms of Buddhism. So they're the ways of describing our sense experience. So if we look at 22, having heard that right at the top there, having heard the teaching, we know this. See you there? So birth is dukkha. You're not there. Page 22, second from the top. Second English from the 22. 22. My 22. Having heard the teaching, we know this.
It's a line or two down.
Yeah. Well, kind of at the top. You there? Again, I don't do this usually. Having heard the teaching, we know this. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, and death is dukkha. So dukkha, the word dukkha is used in several ways. Sometimes it means suffering. It's used in three ways. We'll do a bit of academic stuff here. It's used in three ways. Dukkha is conventionally a dukkha vedana, dukkha saccha, and dukkha is characteristic. So dukkha vedana is the feeling of unpleasantness that we might have. So sukha, dukkha, pleasant, unpleasant. So I feel the warmth of the room. It's pleasant. I come in here. I don't have my coat outside. I feel the unpleasantness of the cold. So dukkha, sukha are part of our sense experience, pleasant, unpleasant, and we have neutral. Dukkha saccha is a truthful, or is in the Four Noble Truths, that there is suffering, that there's a cause of suffering, there's the end of suffering, and there's a path which leads to the end of suffering. So that's when dukkha is used as a truth. Then dukkha as characteristic is that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease and is unsatisfactory. And it's unsatisfactory because there is nibbana. And that's what the Buddha was pointing to, that there is liberation from this duality of pleasant, unpleasant. So it's unsatisfactory. So you get this kind of strange statement that happiness is unsatisfactory. And, well, what's that about? But if you see what it's pointing to, is that happiness is not unhappiness. That's not what it's saying. It's just that happiness, if you rely on it, then unhappiness throws you in the pits. But if you see that unhappiness is unstable, happiness is unstable, as is unhappiness, but happiness is unstable, it's unsatisfactory. When it changes, that's the way it's supposed to be. And the mind moves to disappointment, whatever. So the enlightenment is that which is stable, that which is satisfactory, that which is beyond birth and death, beyond change. Okay? So these three ways you see this word dukkha. So people who don't understand Buddhism, they say, well, Buddhists say everything is dukkha. Yeah, okay. I think the last pope did that in his book. He did a description of the different, his take or the curate's take, whoever's take on the different religions, and they said that Buddhism was a nihilistic religion because they said that everything is suffering. That is not Buddhism. Right? It's not Buddhism. That's some kind of misinterpretation of Buddhism. And you could see how that might happen. I mean, one could understand the misinterpretation. But I don't think the Buddha's enlightenment was an unhappy affair. right? I think he's a pretty together being. So this word, dukkha, has been misunderstood and so on, but it's used in three different ways. So when it's unsatisfactory, when we use the word unsatisfactory, it says don't grasp that which is unsatisfactory. So enjoy the sunshine and the sound of the morning dove, you know, but when you get chainsaws and a dull November day, that's all right too, right? So you don't attach. So non-attachment to happiness does not mean being glum. It just means it's limited. Know its limits. Anyway, so birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, and death is dukkha. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Association with the disliked is dukkha. Separation from the liked is dukkha. Not attaining one's wishes is dukkha. And then bang, it goes. In brief, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. And that's where you have the word khanda. So the Pali is sankhitena panchupadana khanda dukkha. And this is this idea of the five khandas. So rather than like talking about external social things, the Buddha, this teaching then jumps to the mind. Death, not getting what you're getting what you don't want, not getting what you want, separation from the loved one is suffering, and so on. And the problem is attachment to the five khandas. Right? So it jumps to consciousness, experiences of consciousness. And that's where the problem lies. So it's a problem. The problem the Buddha is dealing with is an inner problem, not a social problem. The social problem the teachings deal with too, about being moral, being responsible, being, you know, practicing self-sacrifice, practicing generosity, and so on. Those considerations are there. So the teaching is a kind of twofold teaching. One is conventional truth or social truth that we all live in, and that's where morality and the sense of personhood is important. I am Viradhammo, I have responsibilities, and I have a passport, and here's the one, I have to fill in a tax form this year. Last time I filled in a tax form, I was trying to remember, maybe 1978. So I've done it once in my life. I've managed to stay out of the system. But now I'm on OAS, is it OAS? All day security. So the monastery gets this check, which goes, you know, to pay the electrics or whatever, and I have to pay taxes. So on a conventional level, this character has to pay taxes. So there's that reality that we talk about, and that's what we call conventional reality. But then the liberating reality, or the transcendent reality, or the way to get out of suffering is an inner thing. Both are important. Don't pay your taxes, go to jail or whatever. Be irresponsible, have no friends. Don't take care of your body, get sick, be very difficult to be mindful, and so on. So those are very, very important. But here on a retreat, what we're doing is we're focusing on the inner world and what the Buddha was talking about. So then you get more a teaching which is about stream of consciousness. Now, stream of consciousness, like what in English literature, if the professor could tell me, is usually about thought, I guess. I don't know. When I used to read, Miller? Henry Miller, was that it? He's kind of, or Joyce, right? Stream of consciousness. You know, I just found out that Beckett wrote in French because he was so influenced by Joyce, he didn't want to be like Joyce. So then he wrote in French. That's what I read. Someone can tell me if it's true. He wrote in French so that he wouldn't, and then he translated back into English. Cool. Amazing. Anyway, that is nothing to do with anything here. So back to taxes. Where am I? Okay, back to the five khandas. Back to the five khandas. Okay, so the way we look at stream of consciousness is not just in thought, but in the whole business of being incarnate in a sense body. And this is the way in Buddhism it's described. You could have other ways of describing this experience of being a human being. You could have other categories, but these are the categories that are used in Buddhism. And they're helpful to sort of get your head around, because many teachers will say, don't attach to the khandhas. It'll be a short form, right? If you don't know, you know what they're talking about, it's difficult. So it's a helpful set of words to understand. So in brief, the five focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. These are as follows. Identification with the body, rup upadana kando. So upadana is sometimes attachment or identification with. Rupa is body. Vedana upadana kando, identification with feeling. Feeling in this sense, vedana, is the feeling of attraction and repulsion and neutrality that we have in all sense experience. I hear the sound of the morning dove, mourning, and I'm drawn to that, and it's because it's pleasant. And then maybe I hear someone yelling at each other and screaming at each other, something that's unpleasant. So there's a kind of push and pull in sense experience, in bodily sensation, in sight, in sound, in mental imagery. And that's called vedana. And all we would say in Buddhism, all mind moments have vedana in them. And it's like a gradation from very, very strongly repulsive to very, very strongly attractive and to somewhere in the middle neutrality, and that's always changing. And that's just a given. If that didn't exist, if I stepped on a nail and I didn't feel bad about it, you know, the nail would be on my foot, it'd go septic, and I'd be crippled. So it's there for a purpose. It's there for a purpose. There's nothing wrong about it. Vedana, sanyupadana kando, identification with perception. Perception is how we build up the world. It's based on memory. You come in here, and you sit on your cushion, you don't sit here. If you sat here... You know where you're supposed to sit. You know where the meal is going to be. Perceptions build up. You know that's a fan. That's a tree. You know what snow is, right? This is snow. Color blue. So our whole, the way we construct this world is through perception or through memory. So that's a fundamental part of being conscious. It's just a fundamental part of having... being in this kind of body sense system. Sankarupadana kando, identification with mental formations, with thoughts and all the complexity of thought that it brings forward. Vijnanupadana kando, identification with consciousness. In this sense, it's consciousness of sights, of sounds, of smells, of tastes, of bodily feelings, and of mental imagery and the combinations of those emotions and so on. So this is, in a sense, everything, if you want to get it down. This is everything you experience, right? And basically, the Buddha is saying everything is unsatisfactory, except what? Well, the gateway is awareness. Awareness of change, of all these things changing, and abiding as awareness takes you to the unchanging. It's the gateway. An attachment to that which changes takes you to birth and death, change. So it's not wrong to try to make your coffee a bit warmer by putting it into the microwave, and it's not wrong to... And whoever's doing the temperature in this room, congratulations. This room, I remember, it was always too hot, or so the manager of the stove, Sadhu. Marco, brilliant. You remember, it used to be so hot. Another digression, sorry. I'm getting there. Okay, so this is the way in Buddhism we talk basically about everything. Everything you're experiencing. Body, feeling. And then feeling in this sense is not like emotional feeling. It's a sense of being drawn to or being repelled by or neutrality. Now the thing about all that, you can notice that. You can be aware of that. You can notice like how one person might be very attractive to you and one person might be quite disturbing to you. You're drawn to one person and you're kind of repelled. You can actually notice that. So that, we say, is an object of mind because you can know it. You can feel happy or unhappy. You can feel pain or not pain. So these are all objects of consciousness, we'd say. Okay? So then the teaching goes on. For the complete understanding of this, the Blessed One in his lifetime frequently instructed his disciples in just this way. In addition, he further instructed, the body is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, mental formations are impermanent, consciousness is impermanent. The body is not self, feeling is not self, perception is not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. All conditions are impermanent. So all these objects of awareness, that's what we're trying to bring forth, is what we call anicca sanya, the perception of impermanence. So let's say that I wake up feeling really crappy. You know, oh God, I don't want to meditate. It's terrible, you know. And you say, oh, this is changing. This is a changing mood. If you can get there, that this is a changing mood, you've already got, you have it in perspective. If I attach to that, oh, I don't want to meditate today, you become that. You become enmeshed in a kind of belief system that it's really awful, and you can carry that for a long, long time. So the perception of change is very important. And when one learns to hold that perception, this moment is changing, you can't grasp anything. Like if you just do that, like just notice how things are changing. You can't pay attention to anything. You just have to pay attention to change. And your mind recedes into silence, recedes into non-attachment, I would say. So in our teaching constantly, we're recommended to bring up anicca sanya, the perception of change. It's a way of perceiving, right? A way of interpreting, a way of knowing. And that is the particular, that's why we talk about change so much, as a kind of contemplative tool, rather than as a philosophical position. Some people kind of, you know, I'm a Buddhist, so I believe in change. So what? You know, how does that really help? And then it's just the kind of position you take. But actually, as an ongoing doing, as it were, as a kind of doing, you can see it. You can apply it to something difficult, like, again, going back to that reference to those couple of months with my mom, the memory of my mom after my mom had died, and the feeling was very permanent. The feeling was, oh, God, this is going to go on forever. And then I just bring up, yeah, but this is changing. How is it changing? And I'd see it is morphing. It was still ugly or difficult or painful, but I kept getting perspective on it. You keep getting perspective on it. You kind of abide as awareness of that. So I want to read something else. You've got a few minutes, you know. Go. what I wanted to describe was what we mean by objects, okay? Because this reading has objects in it. So this is what we mean by objects. Objects aren't just like apples and pears and people. They're this inner interchanging experience. So, where are you? You are here. You want to know how Ajahn Chah meditated?
Yes.
People have asked me about my own... This is another digression. People have asked me about my own practice. This is Ajahn Chah speaking. How do I prepare my own mind for meditation? There's nothing special. I just keep it where it always is. They ask, are you then an arhant? Arhant means someone who's enlightened. Are you then an arhant? Do I know? I am like a tree, full of leaves, blossoms, and fruit. Birds come to eat and to nest, yet the tree does not know itself. It follows its nature. It is as it is. You can do that for a lifetime, can't you? Just work with that image. That's where imagery is really, it goes kind of, I know, I find that very powerful because it makes you imagine something in a totally new way. Another digression. Anyway, this is what I wanted to read. So I'll read this a couple of times because it's quite dense. But it relates then to the Four Noble Truths. Right? And the Four Noble Truths are that there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering, there's the end of suffering, and there's a path which leads to the end of suffering. Suffering has to be understood. The cause of suffering has to be abandoned. and the path has to be developed. Okay? And then the abandonment and the abandonment of suffering, the end of suffering has to be realized. And suffering is caused by attachment to desire. Desire for objects. Attachment to the rim, as it were. Okay? We must therefore begin with the analysis of desire. What do I want? Can my desire be gratified by the possession of objects? So that's why, you know, what I'm thinking of is the five khandhas there, the objects. Objects, are they what I seek? Do they contain what I seek? Let us observe what happens when a desire is satisfied. We see that the gratification of a desire is nothing but its death. And therefore, when we are in search of bliss, we really are pursuing nothing but the death of desire. So that's a way of thinking of the third noble truth. Cessation or nirodha, the cessation of desire, the end of desire. We see that the gratification of a desire is nothing but its death, and that therefore we are in search of bliss. We really are pursuing nothing but the death of desire. This proves that our ultimate desire is non-desire. But non-desire appears to our normal consciousness as being blankness. And yet, it is in this blankness that we must try to probe with open eyes so as to discover its true nature. In fact, this nothingness is experienced by everybody in infinitesimal gaps, which occur between thoughts each time one desire dies, giving place to the next. If from time to time we experience moments of stillness and deep attention turned towards these gaps of nothingness, little by little the emptiness will reveal itself as being full, and finally as supreme plenitude. One should adopt this attitude as often and as clearly as possible, thereby allowing it to be more penetrating and effective. With this in view, one should be available, ceaselessly questioning oneself, calmly observing one's own behavior without passion. A new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us, and we may come to understand that we are not the ego. We may then, with a complete and new awareness, taste the unexpected flavor of those moments of non-desire, which will be revealed as being plenitude, silence, and peace. This flavor, which is only fleeting at first, will become more constant and vigorous until that time when it will appear as a reality which carries us, enfolds us, and is our very substance. The bliss which is then experienced is entirely different from what we usually call happiness. For at this level of consciousness, one cannot even say, I am happy, since a consciousness which establishes a distinction between subject and attribute would be a dual consciousness. We have mentioned watchfulness and availability. These are two really good words, I find. Watchful, but available. So often, you know, like with mindfulness practice, we're watching for something, you know, because we had an experience or we read something. So we're watching in order to get something, to see something, to realize something, and we're not available. Our mind is already biased by wanting something. Something we've read, something we, quite often something we experience in meditation. We have mentioned watchfulness and availability. It must be understood that these must be perfect in their quality. The quality and the purity of attention which result are the essential conditions of success. The exercise of this pure attention implies the complete elimination of all elements from the past, thus allowing the authentic purity of the present to be completely grasped. We must forget everything and wait, yet wait for nothing. This entails a state of complete receptivity, which seizes and is open to the complete, eternal, and perfect newness of each moment. Wow. Once more. Now, there's a lot. I mean, I've been reading this for 20 years. I don't think, I mean, every retreat I seem to come back. This is such a, for me, it's such a good way of summing up desire and the end of desire. It really points to the Four Noble Truths for me. And these words, you know, you take a word, that's what I find in my own practice. Words as theory, fine. But words as like mirrors of awakening, so like watchful. Like bring up a word like that, watchful and available. I mean, what does that do to your mind? I find that really helpful, available, watchful. And that creates a certain tone or attitude to the practice. Very, very helpful. And I think all of us, we find words like that. You know, we find a word, yeah, that's a good word. And then we use that as a, not just as a kind of dogmatic position or an opinion, but is actually a tool. And this is what the contemplative life is about. It's introducing our intellect as a kind of reflective tool and ideas. Dutiyampi. Second time. We must therefore begin with the analysis of desire. What do I want? Can my desire be gratified by the possession of objects? Well, you could say, yeah, that ice cream is great, right? But do it, you know, get what you want, and then watch how long before you want something else. Like read a really good book, but look at the end of the book, right? You think, where's the next page? Oh, I'll check my emails. You know, like really, really look at. Yeah, right. This is not so you don't kind of feel guilty because you want to read something, but really look at when a desire is satisfied. When is the desire actually satisfied? And well, how does that work? Attachment to desire, does that really get you there? Huh? This isn't dismissing desire. It's like comfort and all those things are fine, but you know we're obviously searching for something, interested in something deeper and more profound. Objects, are they what I seek? Do they contain what I seek? Let us observe what happens when a desire is satisfied. We see that the gratification of a desire is nothing but its death, and that therefore we are in search of bliss. We really are pursuing nothing but the death of desire. This proves that our ultimate desire is non-desire, but non-desire appears to our normal consciousness as being blankness. So I'm suggesting, like, you know, like when we listen to sound, my suggestion is, like, really reflect on non-desire, non-becoming, and really notice in meditation this sort of anticipation for something, trying to get somewhere, trying to figure something out. Notice that the levels of tension that can engage you in. Sometimes we're not even aware of that. So non-desire, receptivity, availability is a really, really skillful language. And yet it is in this blankness that we must try to probe with open eyes so as to discover its true nature. In fact, this nothingness is experienced by everybody in infinitesimal gaps which occur between thoughts, each time one desire dies, giving place to the next. So I'm suggesting that notice the end of a thought. You got to go deeply into that rather than get caught in that which most of us have been through. Oh gosh, I'm thinking too much. Now I have to try harder. Which is another object. It's just another thought. So if that thought comes up, I have been thinking too long, that's just a thought. Don't believe it. Right? Don't also disbelieve it and say, well, actually, no, I haven't been thinking very much. It's like you bang on there, that's just a thought. That's just a perception. I have been thinking too much. No. And you're with the stillness again. See what I mean? Because that little thought can take you into really trying. And then what do you find? You're lost for half an hour. Have you ever noticed that? You know, I'm really going to try hard now. I'm not going to think. And you're in Thailand. How did I get there? Whereas that noticing this is just a thought. You begin to see the presence is always there. You're kind of getting behind all this movement. If from time to time we experience moments of stillness and deep attention turned towards these gaps of nothingness, little by little the emptiness will reveal itself as being full, and finally as supreme plenitude. One should adopt this attitude as often and as clearly as possible, thereby allowing it to be more penetrating and effective. So the way I do it, like that gap, and I've continued to try to do it, I say, oh, that's it. It's enlightenment. Finished. And I try to make my mind happy with that. Oh, great. Rather than, oh, God, you've been thinking too much, you basket case. You know, been a monk for 40 years and you can blah, 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 blah. No, great. And the happiness of the heart there is non-desire. See what I mean? So you can kind of suggest to yourself these things, attitudes, which are very helpful. You kind of suggest to yourself, this is how we use right intention. You make a suggestion. Notice the end of thought. You notice that, or that sense of self trying to do something. With this in view, one should be available, ceaselessly questioning oneself, calmly observing one's own behavior without passion. A new and non-objective outlook may then progressively prevail on us, and we may come to understand that we are not the ego. Progressively prevail on us. You know, that begins to dominate one's interpretation of life. Rather than you becoming something, you think, yeah, there's a truth there. There's something quite accurate there. We may then, with a complete and new awareness, taste the unexpected flavor of those moments of non-desire which will be revealed as being plenitude, silence, and peace. This flavor, which is only fleeting at first, will become more constant and vigorous until that time when it will appear as a reality which carries us, enfolds us, and is our very substance. And this, for me, would be faith. This is what I would say is faith in my practice. Not faith as belief, law of karma or something like that, but trust. And when you say I often ask that of people, don't I? I say, so what do you trust in? Do you trust in your ego thoughts? And sometimes we do, don't we? It's very disappointing. We get caught up with our self disparagement and self criticism and so on. So but what can we really trust in? And as Ajahn Amaro says, trust in the gap. Trust in the space. Yeah? Trust in that knowing. Yeah? So you question yourself. Doubt is a very, in the five hindrances you have doubt, in the three fetters you have doubt. You know? So doubt or uncertainty is a very tricky kind of condition. Because it's unpleasant, right? And because we like certainty and we love snow, especially in April, it's just great to have it. uncertainty is where you go beyond intellect. Because if I feel uncertain and I have doubt and I try to figure it out, I might get an answer. And in some areas, I need to use thought, like, yeah, what time is my appointment, and is my passport okay, etc.? Do I have insurance to travel, and so on? So that's fine. But in the spiritual life, certainty and uncertainty are both objects. And that happens in meditation. You think, is this what he means? I'm not sure. Now, if you just know, this is the feeling of not sure, then you have faith in knowing. But if you have faith in thought, then you try to figure it out, which is okay. You know, it's not illegal. But you can very much just move from doubt to idea, doubt to idea, doubt to idea, and never actually get off the cycle of intellect. So intellect, rather than as an ultimate position, intellect as a tool. So some of the ways that, like in the Sino-Buddhist tradition in China, they would use doubt. They'd say, who am I? Wato. And that's a kind of a dumb question to ask because there's no answer. But you kind of make the mind doubtful. Who am I? There's no answer. But then in that very doubt, you let go of the doubt, who am I? And the mind is silent. If you answer it, I'm Viradhammo, you know, it's like a pointless answer. So doubt, you know, like quite often people ask me about meditation techniques or whatever, and it's actually just doubt. It's just doubt. You want to be sure. Just allow yourself to be not sure. This is what uncertainty feels like. And then you find where certainty lies, in knowing change. That's the only thing that's certain. Very important, I think, very important. And then to use doubt skillfully, where it can work. The bliss which is then experienced is entirely different from that which we call happiness. For at this level of consciousness, one cannot even say, I am happy, since a consciousness which establishes a distinction between a subject and an attribute would be a dual consciousness. We have mentioned watchfulness and availability. It must be understood that these must be perfect in their quality, the quality and the purity of attention, which result are the essential conditions of success. So that would be my imagery of riding, getting the balance on the bicycle, getting that sense of balance, and then see, you know, ride the bicycle, which is not a becoming, it's a remembering, for me at least. The exercise of this pure attention implies the complete elimination of all elements from the past. Now is the knowing, the power of now. You know, throughout spiritual literature, we see that. The exercise of this pure attention implies the complete elimination of all elements from the past, thus allowing the authentic purity of the present to be completely grasped. We must forget everything and wait, yet wait for nothing. This entails a state of complete receptivity, which ceases and is open to the complete, eternal, and perfect newness of each moment. So, what does that mean? It means just watch your breath. In a word. But the attitude is important. You know, the attitude of presence. And it's subtle. You know, it's quite subtle. So to stay in the present moment, in the beginning, we just make that the determination. Just that's, I'm just going to do that much, to stay in the present moment. You make that intention. You hold that idea in consciousness. And as your mind goes past in the future, no, present. Just that simple. And then you pick up the object of meditation and so on.